So welcome everybody. Today we are very happy to have Alejandra Castro from the University of Amsterdam, and she will talk about engineering ADS-T gravity. Please keep your microphones muted and only unmute if you want to ask questions. The stage is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Olga. Thank you for the invitation. So, okay, so today I'm going to talk about engineering. And it's something a little bit funny to say in the context of string theory, what do I mean by engineering? So the first thing I want to do with this talk is somewhat explain to you in which sense I'm going to engineer gravity. What does that mean in my context? So let's start with a general statement that I hope it's not controversial. So the first statement is that ADS-CFT provides to us a non-perturbative UV complete definition of quantum gravity in the sitter space, okay? And this is an attitude that I'm going to take very, 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 very serious. In that context, the central question that I will be asking during this talk is basically which conformal field theories, so if I take this as a definition of quantum gravity, I want to know which conformal field theories can capture classical and geometrical properties of gravity, okay? And in order to answer this question, and this is where I want to explain in which sense I'm trying to use this analogy with engineering, is basically I want to understand what are the possible theories. If the quantum field theory is defining for me gravity, I want to know what are then the possible theories of quantum gravity that I can build? Because there should be a well-defined space of which CFTs answer this question. So this will tell me what can I concretely design. And at the same time, as you're answering this question, I also want to need to know what are the materials needed to assemble these theories, okay? So you view the CFTs and the various properties as brick and stone and cement to basically build this theory of quantum gravity. So in that sense, I'll be taking this engineering perspective on this question. Now, there will be a few steps in terms of the strategy. So these are, of course, big questions in our field. They're not old. And so the way that I'm going to be addressing this is the following. So as I told you, I'm going to basically define gravity as via the CFT, okay? So that's, I declare that to be my definition of what quantum gravity is. And in that sense, I think what is interesting of taking this perspective is that it will tell me in a sense, what is basically the space, how do I quantify the space of consistent UV complete theories of quantum gravity. So if I have control over the CFTs, I have control over the theories of quantum gravity. And at the same time, in this setup, what one wants to do is to decode this fundamental mechanism of holography. Now, to be a bit more specific, even further as I go further and further, what do I mean? So in terms of defining the theory, the gravity via the CFT, in the context of this talk, I'll be using this as a way how to indicate what are necessary conditions on this conformal field theory, okay? So not every conformal field theory will be able to describe semi-classical gravity, as we know. So what are these conditions? What are the space of these conformal field theories that I'm trying to quantify? And in understanding how does holography work, what is this mechanism behind it, the important question, the key question here is not just listing necessary conditions, there's many necessary conditions, but actually trying to understand what are the sufficient conditions for this to be true, okay? So basically getting at the core of what is actually needed. Now, I will focus this at the title of my talk said, I'm not going to do this in any dimensionality. The seminar is going to focus on the difficulties and how do you answer these questions in the context of ADS-3, CFT-2. There's a lot of very special things that will happen in this context. There's very special symmetries that happen because I'm in this number of dimensions. So it's not going to be universal. It will show up a lot in my talk that I'm using very specific tools that are special to two-dimensional conformal field theories. But I think it illustrated the challenges of how do we think of basically, and in some sense, if you want, also bootstrapping quantum gravity via the CFT. Is like, what would it take for me to answer these questions? Given the current state of the art, what am I capable of? What do I have access to? How can we make progress in understanding these questions? Okay. So with that in mind, this talk is going to be basically divided into two sections. So the first section that I'll talk about is the landscape section. So this is based on work, which I should highlight because they're very truly excellent people. So it's based mainly on these three papers here that involve Alex Bellin, Christoph Keller, and my prior PhD student, Beatrix Moman, who's a postdoc right now at McGill, and also work with Nathan Benjamin and Sarah Harrison. And in this part of the talk, I'll be talking about these necessary conditions that I mentioned above, okay? So we'll go through what are the constraints that we're imposing. So what does it mean for the CFT to be able to capture semi-classical gravity? So what are the conditions that we're looking at? And the punchline, what I want you to take out of this section is that I'm not only going to list what are the necessary conditions, but I'm also going to be able of finding families of CFTs that satisfies these conditions, okay? And these will be very specific, very precise examples. They're new examples, and it's going to also compromise an infinite family of conformal field theories that comply with these conditions. So that will be the first half of this talk. Then for the second half of the talk, we're going to dive into the formations of symmetric product orbifolds. So these theories that I'm going to be building are basically based on symmetric product orbifolds. And what I want to do here is basically test further. So we will impose some necessary conditions, but the second part of the talk is basically testing if we have sufficient conditions, okay? So if I have actually achieved what I needed, or if the conditions that I already impose are too weak and not enough to establish that I have a new instance of ADS CFT where the gravity dual can be weakly coupled, basically treated semi-classically. And this part of the computations are based on a very recent paper that we put out a couple of weeks ago, which also involves Luis Apollo, a postdoc with us in Amsterdam, and also a fantastic, very, very talented and a PhD student that is working with me, Susana Ventaya. And I will also be mentioning further work in progress that also involves Nathan and one of my master's students, Yel Dao. So you should keep track. These probably are new names. Pay attention to them because they're quite exceptional people. But very good. So this is basically going to be the structure of this talk. So we'll start diving in into the specifics. So I imagine you're all ready, right? Yes, I can imagine. I'm looking at the little letters bouncing up and down as like, yes, we're all ready. Okay, very good. So let's talk about the landscape of holographic CFTs. And again, like, please ask me questions. Some of these things, I sometimes treat them as review because they've been with me for too long. If something is not clear or some assumption that I'm making is not obvious, please feel free to interrupt. Okay. So the core of this part is basically, okay, let's try to quantify what does it mean to have a CFT that captures classical geometrical properties of gravity, okay? And this is my single slide. The next slide is the very only single slide that I'm going to write something gravitational. So don't expect, I'm not going to, because I'm taking a very CFT perspective on what it means to describe gravity. I'll tell you what I mean by that, but this is the only slide that has something remotely gravitational. So what is the very, very, very basic requirement that we have in mind? Something very general is that we want gravitational theories that have the property that their low energy description is given by a local effective field theory, okay? This is what I mean by having a semi-classical regime of gravity, that I can describe it in terms of a local effective field theory at low energies. Now, to be more precise, I have in mind that in this semi-classical description, I will have an action and the gravitational sector in this low energy perspective is going to be given by the Einstein-Hilbert term. I will have gravity with a negative cosmological constant, this term here. And I will allow this theory, I'm not interested in having only gravitational degrees of freedom. I'm also quite happy on having potentially matter degrees of freedom, but they have to comply with basically these statements that it has to be local and an effective field theory. And so this is going to be basically matter that is in general will be like weakly coupled to gravity. And it can also be matter that has, so for instance, I'm thinking here that you can have scalars, you can have gauge fields, you can have fermions. Very soon we're going to turn all of this into being supersymmetric. So basically think of this and this part of the slide as basically saying, consider your favorite supergravity theory, okay? Things that I'm not considering here because of this crucial statement here is basically that I'm not considering, for instance, higher spin gravity. So that will not fall into this category of local effective field theories. Those are not local theories. Okay, so that's the type of theories that I have in mind. Now, one of the very universal entries in this dictionary, so what we usually casually denote as the large N limit, is that part of the dictionary that tells us how to view this in terms of a dual CFT is that the central charge of the CFT is basically related to the ADS radius and Planck units via the Brown-Hanoff formula. And what tells me that I have basically that this action is the valid part of my action is the fact that this number, so this ratio is very, very big. So I'm in the large central charge regime. So you can view this at this stage as the zeroth order condition of what the CFT needs to achieve. So at the minimum, a necessary condition is that I'm looking for conformal field theories that have very large central charge, period. That's it, okay? So this is like the first condition that you will want to state, okay? Very good. So now with that said, let's move into the CFTs and I'll list some more conditions that are basically implied from this slide. So let's imagine for a moment, very ambitiously, I know that we don't know this, but let's suppose that we know what the space of all conformal field theories are. Okay, so I draw it here in a beautiful circle. Okay, so this is the space of all two-dimensional unitary conformal field theories. Right, and so and just to state the obvious, what do I mean by a conformal field theory? You can think that this basically, if you want each point inside of the circle that will describe a theory is basically defined by some set of primary operators, their OP coefficients, and a given central charge, okay? So let's say that we have a complete classification of this. We don't, but let's think about that space of theories. Now, the theories that I'm interested in principle, are not all of these theories, but what I want to know, it's which of them are holographic, okay? And by holographic, I mean the ones, these CFTs that have the ability in some regime, in some parameter space, the CFTs of their couplings to basically describe this geometrical properties of gravity, okay? To have this classical description. Now, what are these conditions? So, okay, so I told you about the first one. We said already that the central charge has to be very large. But the other thing that is implied basically by the statement that I want an effective, a local effective field theory of gravity coupled to matter, it also puts a restriction on the spectrum of the CFT, okay? Which is actually a harder condition to satisfy. So usually the statement as usually stated is that you want what's called a sparse spectrum, which means that you want very few operators that have conformal dimensions that do not scale with the central charge. So this is usually what we call the light part of the spectrum, okay? So you can have many operators whose conformal dimensions scales with a central charge. Those will correspond to black hole solutions that will be very heavy states in the theory as the central charge increases. But if you have operators with low scaling dimension, so that do not grow as you take this large n limit, you don't want many of those, because basically these guys here, roughly speaking, being a little bit hand wavy, they're basically going to tell you how much matter you have. And you don't want to overpopulate your theory because you don't want to overcome the number of degrees of freedom cannot overcome basically the action that you have. Okay, so that's the sparse condition. Now, so from the point of view of a cartoon of how the spectrum in gravity looks like, so usually a generic theory of gravity, if you only have the Einstein-Hilbert term, let's say, okay, so if you don't have anything else, the spectrum of a gravitational theory in ADS3 will roughly speaking look like, so here I'm plotting this against delta, if you want. So you have basically the vacuum state, which you will call its ADS, empty ADS. And if you only have gravitational degrees of freedom, then the first, besides the descendants, what we will call the boundary gravitons, the first states, there's a big gap in the spectrum of order C over 12. And then the first states are basically the black hole states. So this is like the most dramatic version of having the sparse condition. Okay, so if you just have pure gravity, this is the biggest spectrum that you can have. Sometimes people call it an extremal CFT, extremal in the sense of having the largest gap. But what I'm saying here, okay, I don't want to impose this. This is too hard. This has been shown to be very, very, very difficult to achieve CFTs that have exactly a spectrum that looks like this. I'm going to be more generous because I'm happy to have the theories coupled to matter. And so I'm perfectly fine if there's a few primaries here, but not too many, okay?
Alejandra?
Yes.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? I mean, would you then in principle allow for this type of spectrum? I mean, there are these results which sort of like seem to indicate that maybe just a pure theory of gravity doesn't exist in three dimensions because in the bulk, you get this unphysical spectrum.
Yeah, so I also believe that pure gravity doesn't exist. as a unitary, it depends on what you mean by exist. Okay, the theory of course exists because it can write an action. So there's a sense in which it just exists. But I think you mean in the sense if it's dual to a unitary conformal field theory that has a well-defined, like that complies with the axioms of CFTs that we believe exist. I agree. I think that as part of this program, that's what we're going to be discovering, that there's no such CFT that will basically comply with this, that if you start imposing, so even if you start with this more generous conditions, and then you are capable of quantifying this region, you will find that none of them are extremal in the sense that I'm drawing here. I think that's going to be an outcome. I can't, of course, I haven't been able to prove it. And what people have been proving so far is that if you wanted this very extreme version of the spectrum, you have to do an ensemble average. So this is a way how you can achieve to mimic in an approximate way the properties of pure gravity if you allow yourself to have an average over CFTs. But that's, I find that as illustrating that there's not a dual to pure ADS3 gravity. So from the point of view of how I started my talk, I would say that the Einstein-Hilbert action by itself with nothing else is not a UV complete theory of quantum gravity, or it cannot be completed without having additional matter degrees of freedom, as string theory nicely tells us.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Thanks.
So very good. Great. So this is the these are the two conditions. Now in the context of 2D CFT, so these are conditions that are basically, well, I'm writing them in an ADS3 language. They're basically true in higher dimensions as well, versions of this, but in CFT2, I can make this a little bit more precise. So I don't, like, this is a very vague statement that I'm writing right now. It's like, what does phu mean? So let's quantify the meaning of phu. And so let's say a little bit about what do we expect out of the spectrum. Okay, so how do we think about how many states you're allowed to have depending, based on our intuition of string theory construction. So usually, it's not always the case, but in many cases in string theory, we have three scales at hand, okay? So there's three relevant cutoff, if you wish, or scales that the theory is defined by. So we always have the Planck scale, and in string cases where you have a 10-dimensional description, it's very common to have also as well a string scale, something that's controlled by alpha prime, and you as well have the ADS scale, okay? So these are the three different scales in the theory. When we say that we have a very, very string, we're in a very stringy regime, where we expect a very stringy spectrum, is a case in the context of this notation where the string scale is very close to the ADS scale, okay? This is what I'm going to call a very, very, very stringy regime. And if you're in this regime, based on our understanding of how the string spectrum behaves and in explicit constructions of ADS CFT, if you look at the density of states of operators who basically, so these will be the operators, just to put it into the context of the notation that I was talking before, these are the operators that are not growing with a central charge of the theory. So they have a lot of energy in units of the ADS scale, but not in units of the Planck scale. Their energies are not scaling, they're not black holes, this notation. So these type of states that can be very heavy, but are not scaling with a central charge, they're usually in string constructions, their growth is basically bounded by a Hagedorn growth, okay? So if you encounter a CFT whose operators basically have this behavior, you will say, this CFT is dual to a string theory. That will be your conclusion. So if you have an exponential growth, usually this coefficient here is 2 pi, and it's bounded, it cannot exceed 2 pi, but it could be less depending on exactly how these couplings are related. But basically, this is the famous like Hagedorn growth. Okay, and we call this, this is what we will denote, and we refer to it in our papers as fast growth, okay? Now, so that if I have a CFT that has this behavior, I will not say that I'm dual to classical gravity. You would say you're dual to a string theory, and you're in this very stringy region. Very good. Now, what we are interested in is having instances where you have a very, very parametric difference between the string and the ADS scale, okay? So all your string states become very massive and you don't see them. And so you're in this low energy regime where you have this nice classical action, this low energy effective field theory description, and you don't see any of the string theory stuff. You just see supergravity. So that's what we want, okay? So we want to be in a regime where we have this big division. Now, what does it mean from the point of view of the spectrum? So when I said that I wanted few states, the basic statement that I'm saying, like a way how to say this, is basically that, okay, you can allow for exponential growth, that's fine, but the power that goes up here cannot exceed one, okay? It has to be strictly less than one, okay? So you can have very energetic states, but okay, they're always below the string scale, below the Planck scale as well. And so this is what we call like a slow growth. If you think of it, maybe it might be useful to illustrate how this works. For instance, if you have something like if you think of ADS3 and let's say cross some manifold that also scales with ADS3. So let's say that you have something like ADS3 times MD minus three. So you basically have a D-dimensional box. So both of them have both of these geometries, both the ADS and the M part are governed by some scale L. So think of ADS3 times S3, if you wish. This is the most famous example that we're known with. This value of gamma, for instance, if you just have quantum fields. So basically what I'm doing here, I will be just counting quantum fields inside of this box. Then this value of gamma, it's basically just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. And gamma is D minus one divided by D. And this is always, so quantum fields inside of a box can never reach Hagendorn growth, okay? Even if you take, well, maybe if you decide that the limit D going to infinity is okay. But in general, for any finite value of D, this is always less than one, okay? So if you encounter CFTs with this property, you will feel optimistic that, look, this could be mimicked. But if you have an appropriate compact manifold here, you could mimic this by quantum field theory. So by a local effective field theory, a low energies that are living inside of this box, okay? So this will be our condition. So we're basically looking, this is our sparseness condition. So we want theories that comply with this criteria. Okay, for the light states of the CFT. Very good. So now, how are we going to do this? Well, I have these conditions, but of course, as we all well know, we don't know the space of all conformal field theories. So I'm going to basically look at the space of conformal field theories that is manageable and reasonable to me. And so how we're going to implement these conditions is for a class of theories that are basically supersymmetric conformal field theories in two dimensions built out of symmetric product orbifold theories. And I'm never going to say those words again because it's quite a mouthful. But these are the theories that I'm going to be studying. So I'm going to study a special class of conformal field theories that I'm basically depicting by this circle. And I'm going to ask the question, out of all of those theories, which of them will have the capacity or will show signals that they will be suitable for a holographic description, i.e. meeting the conditions that I'm interested in. Okay, so now, why did I pick this? So basically the symmetric product theories are very easy ways how to increase the central charge. Okay, so they're basically, think of them as like you grab a CFT, and you tensor them m times. And then you do identifications. The orbifold part of this is basically that you're identifying the copies by the symmetric group. Now, why did we pick this class of theories? Is basically because we have mathematical control, okay? So the symmetric product orbifold structure gives us a lot of controls on how to manipulate the spectrum. And also this is quite prominent in string theory constructions for which we know specific CFTs that are built out of this construction. And in some way, I want to demystify those cases. Is that unique? So should, like the two famous examples is for instance, when the CFT is the sigma model of T4 or the sigma model of K3, are those exceptions? Like, is that just like, oh, there's just these two theories that if you do the symmetric product orbifold off and like small variants thereof, you'll be successful? Or how many more CFTs that if you do this construction, can you basically be successful at, okay? And which of them do we already know that are embedded inside of string theory and which ones do we not yet will be new, okay? So that's going to be the strategy. Basically, this is the set of theories that I have. So let's talk a little bit more about symmetric product orbifolds. So the basic idea is that I wanted CFTs with a large central charge and that I have control on the spectrum. So the conditions that I'm imposing at this moment are conditions on the spectrum of the CFT, So I better look at theories where I have control on those things. So as I told you, basically, we're going to look within symmetric product theories, which are tensor a seed theory. So this theory C that you put here on one copy who has central charge, I'll call it C naught to not confuse it with the overall central charge. You basically tensor it many times. You take the limit of this being very, very, very large, which increases the central charge. And this is basically the type of theories that I'm going to consider, okay? Now, in which sense do we have control over the spectrum? Well, there's a very famous and all results by now by Dijkgraaf, Moore, Verlinde, and Verlinde that tells us that for this type of constructions of CFTs, you have this beautiful product formula. So you basically, this is a type of theory in which you could have said, well, back in the day, it was called like the third quantization of string theory. But in some sense, you're doing an averaging in these constructions. So averaging is not new to the past couple of years. We've been doing it for many, many years in a different context, of course. But basically, what these gentlemen realized was that the way to understand these theories and quantify them nicely and elegantly is not to study each instance of M, but actually treat M that governs the central charge, the overall central charge, is to say average over it. So introduce a new fugacity associated to M, treat it as another quantum number that you sum over. And the advantage of that is that the sum that might have looked very, very complicated, it actually boils down to a beautiful product formula, which is quite manageable. It's an extremely easy formula to look at because the powers here are basically the degeneracies of one of these copies. So if you have control of the spectrum of one of the copies, then you know everything that you need to know about what happens. And this includes all types. So in these theories, you have untwisted sectors and twisted sectors. There's all sorts of states. This formula captures everything. And it's quite elegant, very beautiful. This is what gives us control over the spectrum of these theories. So that's quite great. So this is, in some sense, a way how you treat the large N limit in an ensemble way. You treat it as another, in a statistical way. Of course, it's not the same averaging. I'm not averaging over a coupling here in this case, but it's always been useful for us to think about things in the language of statistical physics. And that's what's happening here in the symmetric product theories. Now, one thing though that I should say in this context, so if you grab the full partition function of it, no matter what you put here, so I don't care which theory you pick, one of my collaborators actually showed that it seems like everything that I have been saying and advocated for is not useful. So it's not useful in the following sense. So if you look at these constructions, what Christoph Keller showed many years ago is that all of these theories, no matter what you pick here, pick whatever thing that you want, it doesn't matter. Pick any, well, it only assumes that you have a discrete spectrum if you wish. But basically, just pick your favorite CFT. Any symmetric product or orbifold, it's basically a theory for which if you try to interpret it holographically, it will look like a theory where the string scale is of the order of the ADS scale. So not really what I was looking for. It's not really something that will be dual to semi-classical gravity. So why did I pick these theories? It's an excellent question. And you're all waiting for me to say the answer, but I'll just take a sip of water. So what's going on here? So what's happened? So usually, and this is what happens, for instance, in the D1, D5 system, in these cases of ADS3 times S3, where the symmetric products are very prominent. So yes, indeed. So you think of the symmetric product, basically, if you attach a dual to it, it's basically dual to a world shape theory that has been studied very prominently in this past, well, it's been studying for many, many years, but it has drive new attention in the past few years. But in any case, yeah, so the symmetric product orbifold, you should interpret it as a regime where the CFT is weakly coupled. So these basically these copies, you are identifying them, but they're not really interacting. So in that sense, this is a weakly coupled system. So you have, like, if you want to think of it as brains or whatever, like, basically, the copies are not talking to each other much, okay? Modulo this symmetric identification, but nothing more than that. Now, what happens in the context of the D1B5 system? Well, this is one theory at one point in a moduli space. By moduli space here, I mean that there's going to be some marginal deformation. So there's going to be an operator of conformal dimension 1, 1. And if you turn on this marginal deformation, it's basically turning on, there will be a coupling associated to it. And this coupling basically tells you that you will have some space of theories that you can explore. And hopefully the lore in our field and our expectation is that there's a point in this moduli space that is a strongly coupled point where this, in introducing this coupling, it makes the copies talk to each other. So it induces interactions among the copies. And it drives the theory to a strongly coupled point where we expect to have a big hierarchy between the string and the ADS scale. Okay, so this is how we understand, for instance, the D1, D5 system. That's our current understanding of it. There's not much that is known about this point. This point is still quite, or at least to me, from a CFT point of view, it's quite mysterious, but this is what we expect out of cases that are occurring in string theory. Now, in that context then, so what I'm going to say is, like, okay, so anytime you have a symmetric product theory construction, you should think of that in terms of this cloud, in terms of this moduli space. So yes, this theory is not going to be dual to semi-classical gravity, but the following are understanding of D1, D5, if you have an exactly marginal operator, maybe there's some hope that you can deform the theory and find a strongly coupled point. So what we're going to do is basically in this first part of the talk is that we're going to require that if you look at the space of symmetric product theories, they should have this marginal deformation. But also the other important point is that there will be some quantities that are protected under this deformation. So even if you do computations at weak coupling in the symmetric product, the quantities that are protected, that are basically not sensitive to the deformation, should already display gravitational features. So the first thing we're going to do is basically try to figure out what are those quantities that already display gravitational features. And then basically ask the question, is that enough? And if you turn on the marginal deformations, what will be signals that you have a strongly coupled regime? Okay. Is that somewhat clear? Yeah. Okay.
Let me maybe ask just a quick, like, really different question. What happens to the low-lying spectrum? So I guess I would have expected that you take a bunch of copies, then you get like an M-fold copy of light operators. But
yeah, so that's why they are. So if you just take M copies, then they will fail at every sense. So there's way too many states. It's not even a string theory. It's just like crap. What the symmetric group does for you, it's a version of gauging. So you're gauging the theory. So that removes then a bunch of states. But not enough, and it basically removes them such that you get Hagendorn growth. But that's still stringy. And so what we're going to do then with this deformation, those states that have Hagendorn growth, what we expect is that then if you turn on this deformation, then all of this thing is going to, they're not protected operators. So the not protected operators should get an anomalous dimension. And that will tell you, they're much heavier. And so they will start acquiring masses that are compatible with a string scale. And so they go up in the spectrum. And then when you are still in this ADS scale, you're happily with very few states that remained that are not affected by this. So that's the idea. But yeah,
thanks.
So a lot of the states in this metric product orbifold are going to become very, very heavy as you move in this moduli space. That's that.
Is there a way of sort of like counting those protected operators which will stay light so that you...
So the first thing that we're going to do is count protected operators and make sure that there's very few of them. And then the second thing, so if the protect, because the protected operators will not, I'm going to look at the Lipschitz genera that counts states that are weighted by -1 to the F. So I have to be a bit careful. Some of the quarter BPS states are going to get lifted, some of them not. But in any case, if I forget about the -1 to the F for a second, the statement is like, yes, if something is protected, they should already display gravitational features. And so it already has to be way less than Hagedorn, basically. And then anything that is protected, that is not protected, the lore, it's not a theorem, but what we believe that is going to happen is that if you turn on this deformation, they're going to start getting lifted.
Okay,
cool. Okay, so let's focus on that. And I'm going a little bit slowly. So let me go through what did we do. So I'm almost done with this part of the section. So, okay, so to refine a bit more, what are these? So in the context of studying the supersymmetric product orbifolds, so what are the conditions that I'm looking for? So these conditions are catered to these theories listed here. So I wanted the central charge to be large. As I was just telling to Dominic, one of the protected quantities that we looked at is the elliptic genera. This counts quarter BPS states. So I want this partition function, basically, or this index to be very sparse. And then the other condition is that I also want to show that the symmetric product orbifolds actually have a moduli space, so that there is an exactly marginal operator. Okay. And so let's quantify the space of those theories. And the punchline is, so I'm not going to bore you with the details. The outcome is that, well, this elliptic genera, so these things that are counting the quarter BPS states have very special and beautiful modular forms. There's a complete classification of this. This is why we can be basically thorough and exhaustive. So these will be at the minimum 2.2 theories for this elliptic genera to exist. And we basically, what we did from a mathematical point of view was to develop methods to extract the spectrum in the large n limit, okay, efficiently. So to see how many light states do you have in this supersymmetric index and show which of those were Hagedorn and which one of those were less than it, okay? And then from that point of view, we basically can fully diagnose. You give me your favorite supersymmetric theory, we construct the symmetric product, and then we can just check, basically, does it meet these necessary conditions or not, okay? So our papers basically show those methods. And the thing is that every time we found something that is slow growing, so we basically identified, we're capable of identifying the examples that have slow growth. Something that is very curious is that they all have square root growth behavior. So it's less than Hagedorn. That's great. So that's a good sign. But there's no other power. So before, for instance, remember that I told you that the value of gamma was d minus 1 divided by d. We thought that maybe depending on which theory you had, you would have different values of this gamma. No, it's always square root. So there's no other options. So it's either Hagendorf. So basically you can have, there's many, many forms that will give you even the elliptic genera. Most of the elliptic genera actually grows like Hagendorf. And then we were capable of identifying those that didn't, and those that didn't happen to just have the square root behavior. So it's basically binary, like it's either delta or square root of delta. That's it. So that we proved.
And this behavior happens abruptly at C0 equals to 6, the transition from—
Yeah, the transition is abrupt. It ends exactly at C. So this is the other thing that we proved. Wanted to use the pointer. So this was also quite beautiful. So we showed from the point of view of the weak Jacobi form that controls the counting of the elliptic of, well, it's basically the modular form involved here. There's basically a restriction on the index of the form. And if as you interpret it, the Jacobi form as a CFT, if the central charge is bigger than 6, it's always going to be Hagendorf. Doesn't matter what you do, okay? No matter what, you won't be able to, the elliptic genera, unless, yeah. So the elliptic genera, the Jacobi form, if it has a central charge, the seed has a central charge that is bigger than 6, always Hagendorf. It's never going to be slow growing, never.
So I didn't click here. These are 2.2 or 0.2?
2.2. If it's 0.2, I lose control on the, I can't say anything about the 0. So that's my problem. I basically have to make sure that the elliptic genera is meaningful for the whole theory, that's all. So I'm assuming that if I compute trace of -1 to the F of Q to the L zero, J to the Y to the J zero, that this is something that it's protected on both sides. If it's 0.2, I only have BPS states on one side. And so then I have nothing to say about the other side, basically.
Is the difference just that you have a Jacobi form as opposed to modular form, or is there more than that?
No. It's more. It's just that I don't know what it means. If you only have supersymmetry on one side, I don't have anything to say about the other part of the spectrum. That's all. Like, there's nothing protected.
I mean, when you say quarter BPS, you mean things counted by the elliptic genus, right?
Yeah, exactly. So also, and the quarter BPS, I'm already assuming that I have
No, but I don't understand what special property of quarter BPS in 2.2 versus half BPS in 0.2.
There's nothing No. It's just like how much control I have over the overall spectrum. That's all. There's no different, like it's, if you want, you can apply this for 0.2, but it's just that I don't, sure.
I'm just trying to understand which kind of control would you get from 2.2 besides the fact that they're Jacobi forms instead of modular forms.
No. These are always Jacobi forms. So I should, sorry, this is always a Jacobi form. So I should.
I understand because it's 2.2. But yes. If it was 0.2, maybe you would not have the Y. It would have just modular forms.
Yeah.
But otherwise.
That's actually even more powerful in some sense, but wouldn't you just get then the Witten index? I think it just collapse or not. Does it collapse fully?
No, I'm saying for 0.2, you just get it. Something that looks like the elliptic genus. I don't think the elliptic genus 2.2 theories is much different in structure than one of 0.2. Except that the 2.2 ones is great, you know. Has that symmetry fugacity too that you can
No, if you want to be honest, we only applied it, if you read our papers, we were more modest and we only said things about 2.2. It's just that we were nervous. I think the only reason was that, right, because you have in some sense for the 2.2s, it didn't matter on which side you impose supersymmetry, so then it, like, because you can look at the supersymmetric states when you put, like, I don't know, the left movers in the ground state and then just look at the other excitations, or the other way around, you can put the right the left movers in the ground state and then look
at I don't remember how do things work for marginal deformations. It's 0.2.
That's also, well, that's the other part that I will get nervous about. So for us, the deformation is it's built out of a half BPS state, so it's supersymmetric on both sides, and so then I know that the deformation exists throughout the moduli space. So if it's 0.2, maybe you can make some statement about the sparseness, And you can make a statement that a marginal operator exists at that point, but then it probably will get lifted.
I don't think it can get lifted because this, the dimension of the supersymmetric side doesn't change.
Oh, and then the spin
and will the say spin cannot become.
Ah, that's a good point. So sorry, maybe I'm being. So if supersymmetry already, well, is this a from this language? Sorry, I should say quarter BPS states are not necessarily protected, though. I think you needed supersymmetry on both sides to claim that something is protected. So the elliptic genera is protected because you have a minus one to the F. But a given, like, if you actually count supersymmetric, like all BPS, quarter BPS states, the growth. So for instance, like, so if you instead counted D of all, so this is the D with the minus one to the F, it's square root. But of all of them, at least in the supergravity point, this goes like 3/4.
Yeah, I guess you're right, the dimension of the...
Yeah, so you have to be careful. We don't expect all quarter BPS states. And actually people, some of the work that Christoph did with Aida Sade and Nathan actually showed how some quarter BPS states can get lifted by the, even in the cases where you have 4.4 or 2.2. So I think that, yeah, it's not enough. I can't show that in a 0.2 theory, I really have a marginal operator that is protected. I need the other two.
Okay.
Okay. Very good. So basically, these are things. So we impose, this is a very, like, from our point of view, it's a very generous bound, but we actually, basically it already restricts quite a bit what are all the types of CFTs that you can look like at, so you don't have to look at all of them, ones that have are bounded by the central charge being 6, which is actually exactly what happens for K3 and T4. They have the seed theory has central charge C equals 6. That's what's happening. And in that context, we basically, because we have this power, we can basically classify the theories that go into that intersection. Oof, and I'm running super late on time. So I wanted to show you what are some of these concrete
examples. You can take 5 to 10 minutes more if you want, because you have many questions, so don't worry about that.
Okay, thank you. But it's just, I fear it will take me more than that. So I will go probably this last part that is more technical. I won't go through it. But to show you that we are really looking at, like, we can really nail down very, very specific theories. So theories that are in this range between having central charge between 1 and 6. Some of them are, for example, supersymmetric Virasoro minimal models. Okay. So actually, if the seed theory has central charge less than 3, you know all the theories that have 2.2. The classification is complete. So we didn't even have to, like, we just know what all CFTs are in that range of central charges. Between 3 and 6, of course, the classification, we know many examples of supersymmetric theories, but I don't know that we know all of them. But in this range, it's complete. And the thing that is quite beautiful is that all of these minimal models comply with our criteria. They have very slow growth, which is great. And they also have, if you build them into the symmetric product orbifold, we basically found their moduli spaces. So they have exactly marginal deformations that are protected. So to illustrate the moduli space here, I'm just listing basically for the A, the D, and the E series, what are their moduli space? So it's quite interesting. There's untwisted moduli, there's twisted moduli, and also within the twisted moduli, so some of them will look like multi-trace operators, some of them will look like single trace operators. And so here we singled out which of the twisted moduli are actually single trace operators. And usually in the cases that you might be familiar, so in the case of D1, D5, it is a twist 2 operator, but you can see here that the things get quite more interesting. These theories allow for twist 3, 4, even 5 and 7, and 4 is also a number that shows there. Okay, so they meet basically all of these theories, all of these minimal models meet these three criteria when you do the symmetric product orbifold of them. So this is quite nice. Okay. Now, the question is, so these are the same criteria. Just to be clear, these are the same criteria that something like D1D5 will meet. And so then the big question is, that's great for you, was this sufficient? So you found CFTs that meet this criteria. So are we done now? So it's like, can you claim that this thing is holographic, or what else do you need to do to show that they will have a string theory dual, let's say, or they will have like a strongly coupled point? Like what do we do with this? Because from a CFT point of view, they're meeting very similar conditions as them, as known examples in string theory. Okay, so one of the things that we decided to do was to look at the deformations. So let's see what happens. What are the effects of these marginal operators? And the thing, I will go through this very quickly because I definitely don't have the time. But the thing that happened, so let me just skip that. So basically, one thing that we noticed in every example that we studied, which was quite fun, is that every time we satisfy the sparse condition, we found that there was an exactly marginal operator. And you might have thought, these are two completely unrelated conditions. Why do you need one and the other? But the thing that is also a little bit worrisome for us, and this is why we decided to start studying this, is that we have examples of theories that have Hagendorn in their elliptic genera, but they also have an exactly marginal operator, okay? So it feels like statements that you want to say about how the moduli space behaves seems to be perhaps uncorrelated if the thing is slow growing or if it's fast growing. And so you might wonder, like, what is the effect of this marginal operator? Like, why was it so, like, is it really tied to it or not? Now, so that was one of our important motivations. And to illustrate this, let me show you a table here that I have here of an example that are problematic. So this is what one of my students, Yolda, was doing. So I asked her to look at theories that where the seed central charge was 5, and a way that you can construct theories that have seed central charge 5 is by basically tensoring minimal models. So that makes the central charge increase. And so for instance, one thing that is nice, so here she listed if it was sparse or if it had this single trace moduli. And so you can see that every time that she claimed this theory is sparse, it also had moduli. There's cases where you have Hagendorn and there's no moduli. That is great. But you can notice here that there's cases where the theory is not sparse, but she established that there wasn't exactly marginal deformation. So that happened. And so these are cases that are basically confusing us. Now, in this context, the important features, as Davide was also asking, there's 3 requirements of this operator. It has to be protected so that we know that it exists throughout. If you're fine with it not existing at some point and then constructing another marginal deformation, that's fine, but this gives us quite a lot of control. It had to be twisted because basically, this is what will induce interactions among these copies and break that structure. And then we also wanted it to be single trace because otherwise it will break the large N structure of the theory, which we like. Okay, so the Toth limit will be destroyed if it's not single trace. Okay, so let's see, let me show you. Okay, so last thing. So the computation that we did was basically, so we turned on this operator, this marginal deformation, that it's supposed to take us to the strongly coupled point. And then basically what we did was look at how the conformal dimensions get affected by that operator. So what are the anomalous dimensions that you acquire? Okay. Now, let me see. I'll show you. So we basically decided to do this for currents. So when you're at the symmetric product orbital point, the other way that you can know that you're not dual to gravity is because within the symmetric product orbital, you can construct higher spin currents. Okay, so these are theories that when you tensor them, they don't just have Virasoro symmetry, but they have enhanced symmetries. And so, for instance, one simple, the first current that you'll encounter is something that is spin four. Okay, so it will look, roughly speaking, like, oh, it's a product of two stress tensors. But okay, of course, this you can always do in any theory. Any CFT will have some state that looks like this, but this is just going to be a descendant. It's not going to be really a current. What's special to the symmetric product structure is that then you can also add terms like this where involve different copies, and this is actually a primary of conformal dimension four. Okay, so those are type of higher spin currents that you can construct. This is an example where you're using the supersymmetric part, the U1 currents and the fermionic currents. And so we basically computed the anomalous dimensions. We want these guys to disappear. Okay, so if you have these currents, they illustrate to you that you have a higher spin symmetry. We don't like that. We want to get rid of those as you turn on the deformation. And we did that. So it's quite tedious. And the only other examples in the literature that were known of similar things to this was in the context of the D1D5, done by basically these very discrete number of papers. So these are cases where the seed theory has C equals six and it's twist two. But we had lots of theories, lots of minimal models that are quite different. And so off we go, we have to do the computation again. And some of the things that we notice, so let me show you two things. So two things to notice in this construction was that the behavior of the deformation was quite not generic. And the behavior of the currents is also something that you have to keep track of. But just to show you what's happening here, so in this table, sorry that I'm going a bit fast, but I should have spoken more fast at the beginning. So in this table here, I'm listing, so these two first columns are basically listing the minimal models that I mentioned before. This N is the twist of the marginal operator. So it's basically indicating which marginal operator we're using. Depending on the theory, it's which marginal operator exists. And here in this last column, I'm basically reporting on the value of that anomalous dimension that they acquire. Okay, and the reason why I have to go through all of these cases is because the behavior of the marginal operator is quite different depending on the case. Okay, it's highly non-uniform. So for instance, the deformation, depending on the value of the twist on the cover, basically can look like a primary again, or it can look like a descendant on the primary. Depending on the value of the central charge, so for instance, for twist four, sometimes it looks, when you go to the cover, it just looks like a descendant, but then sometimes it looks like a primary. And that's why we get like very different numerical values depending on which current you have. Okay, so this is quite sensitive to the choice of deformation. Now, but one thing to keep in mind is that everything lifted, so none of these entries are zero. Here we wrote dash because there's no spin two current for this for C equal to one. So that's why we don't, you can do the computation, you will get something trivial, but there's nothing interesting to say there because the current actually doesn't exist. But basically, every time the current exists, you have a non-trivial anomalous dimension, which is good. That's nice. But the details are quite non-universal. We also did this for spin three, but I will not show it to you because it's too much. And if our results also apply, so you can take the value when C is equal to six. And there's this paper by the group at ETH that had it for T4, and the values basically agree. So at least with one data point known before, things are compatible in the large n limit. Also notice our results are also, we did them at finite n. So then if you want to do something holographic, then you take the large n limit of those results. But okay, I think I'm going to just conclude. So I'm going to conclude. Sorry for rushing through. You can ask me questions afterwards, but I don't want to hold you more than necessary. Okay. So basically what happened today is that we wanted to understand what are these theories of gravity that can admit UV completion by defining them via the conformal field theory. And in this context, and trying to understand what is the space of holographic CFTs, we basically provided for you a different set of conformal field theories that have these holographic properties in the supersymmetric context. They're different from known examples. So that's why I was trying to make some stress that the case that we know in string theory is a case where C is equal to six. All of these other examples don't have C equal to six, the new ones, the minimal models. They're very specific theories. They're minimal models. We know them. We love them. I cannot be more specific than this. So it's a theory for which you know everything that you need to know. And more impressively, this is also an infinite family. So it's not that we found a couple of theories, but we found many of them. Of course, there's many of them that also don't work, but there's many of them that do work. And so with that, I'll just leave you with this slide where here in the bottom, I illustrated some other things that you can consider besides the ones that I was mentioning explicitly during the talk. So with that, I conclude. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the very interesting talk. Are there any more questions for Alejandro?
You had in one of the earlier slides a picture of the spectrum in Delta, where you had ADS, ADS3 at some point, and then there was a gap, and a BTZ. Mm-hmm. At some, that was the next level in
yeah.
The system. I wonder if that's just not possible in any string theory setup where you compactify on some T4 or whatever surface, because you get a tower of Kaluza-Klein modes, which would just fill in the spectrum in between ADS yeah. and possibly something that can be interpreted as a black hole.
Yeah. I agree. So, yes, from a 10-dimensional point of view, you would say, yes, this is, of course, you're never going to get this because of the Kaluza-Klein states. Like, yes. Now, since in this construction, you could have said maybe you discovered. So from string theory, would say this, you're never going to get pure gravity, period. Like, never. This is just because we know. If you want the theory to be anomaly free, it has to live at least in 10 dimensions. So you're done. Now, from the CFT perspective, that's not obvious, right? So here, I know I'm motivating a lot of the things that I'm saying by string compactifications, but from the CFT point of view, you could have said, okay, so I was assuming that you had to commit to supersymmetry. And so you could say, okay, maybe what's happening is that there might be a CFT that is compatible with n equal to supergravity and nothing else. Maybe that's a possibility in the realms of possibilities. I'm
not assuming anything about the UV completion of
yeah. No, I'm not, because this is just a CFT analysis. Like, if you want, the CFT is the UV, but I'm not saying anything about string theory. I'm just saying I have, based on the number of supersymmetries, I have 2.2 supersymmetry, and that's all I have. That's it. Now, none of our computations so far indicate that it will look like pure supergravity. So, I can't falsify it yet, but I just strongly doubt it. Because these quarter BPS states, so we can have like a large N, I can tell you like, these are the quarter BPS states that you should match to basically the multiplets of the supergravity construction. So if you have hypers, vector multiplets, whatever matter your theory has, like these quarter BPS states will match the counting of those multiplets in supergravity. And the powers that you get, they tend to all indicate, like, we haven't done the matching precisely because we don't have a gravity dual to match it to yet. But the way the formulas look, it indicates to us that no, none of these examples will be compatible with a gravity theory where you only have the Weyl multiplet, basically the supergravity, the graviton multiplet, mm-hmm. and that's it, and nothing else. It just
that makes sense. Yeah.
I first have to establish, it might be that the dual to n equal two supergravity, so the counter to this is to say, well, but maybe the dual to n equal two supergravity is not based on a symmetric product construction. So I am assuming that at some point, there's a weakly couple regime of this theory for which it looks like a symmetric product orbifold. And I think from that point of view, you already know that more matter has to exist because the marginal deformation has to exist. And so in that sense, you would say, yes, here you will never find something that only has gravitational degrees of freedom because you're allowing for having like at least another operator in the theory that allows you to move from a weak to a strongly coupled point.
I see. Yeah. That
makes sense. But okay. But you could have said, like, what is the minimal thing that you're allowed if you have this type of string constructions? Like, that's so this is quantifiable now. So now you can, basically what we're telling you is like, don't be afraid. You can quantify the space of conformal field theories in this, at least if you restrict yourself to this to this little corner. So it will not, it doesn't describe all holographic CFTs, it describes some subset of them, but it's still interesting from the point of view of like saying like, okay, there's patches of this landscape that you can just basically cross out and declare it as manageable and under control.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
More questions? If not, let's thank Alexandra again. Thank you.